Hello, podcast listeners, and welcome to this week's episode of the Commercial Connection Podcast. My name is Spencer Taylor, your host, and in this week's episode, we include our webinar from about 2 weeks ago, and we talk about some of the pitfalls and benefits that can happen from a 1031 exchange. I think my key takeaway is ask your questions. Get more information. Call people who might know. Anyway, enjoy. I hope you like it. Thanks.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's webinar. We're so excited to have you. Thank you for joining us. Today, we're going to be talking a lot about 1031 exchanges. But before we kind of dive in, just a few housekeeping items. First, we want to get to all of your questions, as many as we can. Please use the Q&A feature to ask your questions and add any comments you want for the speakers today. Also, this is being recorded. It will be available on demand after the presentation. You'll each get an email with a link to view it on demand. It will also be on our website, millcreekcommercial.com, to view at your pleasure. Feel free to share it. Feel free to pass it on to anyone you feel like could use the information. Okay, we have some really good guests with us today. Mary Cunningham and Eric Brescher from CDEC, Chicago Deferred Exchange Company. Mary is a past president of the Federation of Exchange Accommodators and has worked tirelessly, how do you say that word? Tirelessly. Thank you. She's worked tirelessly on helping maintain 1031 exchanges in our tax code and fighting inside and outside of Congress to ensure that it lives on. So Mary is a thought leader in this industry, and we sure appreciate having her with us. Companion here, Eric Brescher, is an attorney, a certified exchange specialist, so is Mary. And CDEC has helped thousands of people over the years, hundreds of thousands of people over the years, complete successful 1031 exchanges. They make sure all the T's are crossed, all the I's are dotted, so that in the eyes of the IRS, everything is the way it should be. So Mary, Eric, thank you so much for being here with us. We sure appreciate having you.
Hi, thank you, Spencer. We're very excited to be here as well.
Go. I was gonna say, let's just dive in. I mean, let's get talking about 1031 exchanges. Right. And I'll pass the mic over to you, so to speak.
Okay, thank you. Good morning and good afternoon. So Eric and I are going to talk a little bit today about Section 1031, some of the benefits and some of the pitfalls that we've seen investors fall into over the many years that we've both been in the business. But as Spencer mentioned a minute ago, 1031 survived the legislative chopping block, as you may know, back in December of 2017 when the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was signed into law. The effect of that act was to limit the application of Section 1031 to just real property that's held for investment or for productive use in a trade or business. So prior to the TCJA, you could exchange certain types of collectible properties, certain types of capital assets, and intangible properties. Today, 1031 only applies to the exchange of real property. There are three sort of general requirements that an investor needs to meet to qualify for the tax deferral under Section 1031. First, both the property that's sold and the property that is acquired must be held for investment or for use in a trade or business. And we'll talk a little bit about what that means, some of the nuances there. Second, the properties need to be like kind to each other. Generally, real property is like kind to all other real property. And then third, you have to be sure that you structure your transaction as an exchange of one property for another, as contrasted to a sale followed by an acquisition.
And Mary, I think it's good to note that there is a misconception that people need to swap deeds and it has to be a simultaneous transaction. And so now we do have these delayed mechanisms, which we'll spend a little bit more time talking about as well, where something can be sold first and you will be given a period of time to both find some replacement property and then to close on it.
Yes. So why would someone do a like-kind exchange? I mean, the overriding reason is to defer the tax on the disposition of your old property. So you have highly appreciated and depreciated property that you want to sell. Perhaps you want to move a business. Perhaps you want to diversify your portfolio. The primary driver is you get to defer recognizing the gain and paying all of that tax if you reinvest into like-kind replacement property. People also use 1031 for estate planning purposes. So if you are continuously exchanging property on your death, that property today gets a stepped up basis and that property can then be passed on to your heirs. But there are a lot of really powerful reasons why taxpayers may engage in a like-kind exchange.
Do we want to elaborate on this a little?
Sure, go.
Yeah, well, you know, just briefly, again, as Mary said on the top here, we have the tax motivation, of course, is the primary factor why people are doing a 1031 exchange. But coupled with that, it might be that somebody has a single asset and it has greatly appreciated. Maybe they feel that it's, you know, they've added as much value as they can to it, and it's an opportunity to diversify. So one strategy is to buy multiple replacement properties. So that is an option. It's not that you have to sell a single property and replace it with a single property. Geographically, you can sell anywhere in the United States and purchase anywhere else in the United States. Foreign property can also be exchanged for other foreign property. Conversely, consolidation. You may, I know that there are many realtors on the line or landlords as well. Either you or your clients may have accumulated a number of investment properties over the course of their investment cycle, and they can consolidate and trade those into a single asset, put all the proceeds together. Raw land is eligible for exchanging. And so of course that typically does not generate cash flow. So getting out of land that hopefully has appreciated into improved property where you will get that depreciation benefit and also the cash flow. So that's a little bit, some of the, as Mary mentioned, there are estate planning that can tie into it as well.
So Eric, what kind of property is qualifying property for purposes of a Section 1031 exchange?
So that's a good question. It's property that has been held for investment. Now, we did just recently in the final regulations, as Mary alluded to, in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, we did get 1031's exchanges limited to real property, but there was no definition of real property. Now, we did just get that last month. And so, as Mary said, all real property is exchangeable for all other real property. And you see here, you know, again, it's not that you're selling a multifamily and that you have to buy another multifamily. You can buy any other type of real property. And if we just go to the next slide, we've got also just a little bit more detailed of the.
One of the examples I'd like to give is you can sell an investment property, you know, like 32nd floor in Manhattan, you know, like a apartment for, and you can exchange it for farmland in Oklahoma.
Yeah, absolutely. So here you see a whole little more detailed list of real property. And so again, this really is what we've always talked about. And I think some of our differentiating colors on some, but again, co-ops is something that while we always were able to exchange that, you know, depending where you are geographically on this call, and I know we have people coast to coast, but co-ops are a little more prevalent in New York, that's technically stock and lease, which you might think of as not being real estate, but New York does define it as real estate. And so again, these final regulations do say that they're going to look to state law to define real property. So that's something that's been a little more codified now. But all of these options have now been blessed, and we'll probably get a little bit more guidance on that. And so again, all of these can be exchanged for one another as long as the intent upon acquiring that property is that it is held for investment property.
So back in 1991, the Treasury Department issued regulations that created this concept of a qualified intermediary who becomes sort of the party with whom the taxpayer is exchanging their property. And in the old days, prior to the regulations being issued, the IRS used to be of the view that you had to do a simultaneous swap of properties in order for the transaction to be respected as a good like-kind exchange. These regulations provide very taxpayer-friendly safe harbors that anyone can avail themselves of. And if you've been engaged in these transactions, you know that the qualified intermediary is the party that you need to get in touch with prior to closing on the disposition of your investment property. The QI is tasked with holding the proceeds from the disposition and protecting them until you're ready to redeploy those proceeds into the purchase of replacement property. And so if we go to the next slide, we have our very first pitfall example. So let's say, Eric, you get a call from a taxpayer who sold their property yesterday and they want to do an exchange. They have the cash in their bank account. What are you going to tell them?
Well, unfortunately, on a couple of levels. First of all, having actual receipt of the funds will blow your 1031 exchange. But really, more importantly than that, even if the escrow agent or the attorney were holding the funds, which we deem constructive receipt, the biggest issue is that they did not set up the exchange in advance and have the mechanisms in place via the exchange agreement, the assignment agreement, all of these procedural issues that you have to fall within that safe harbor. And unfortunately, within the last 3 months, I've had three occasions where people have called me and either sold it and they didn't take the money, but they never set it up. So yeah. It's an unfortunate situation. And again, as for all the realtors on the call as well, I would just caution you, there are many misconceptions, and unless you feel you're really an expert, we're always happy to be a resource. There was a case, Kuhn versus Woods, where the client was advised that they had already done an exchange and that they couldn't do it again. And so that was an unfortunate situation. 1031s can be done over and over again. And for the realtors on the call, it's your best friend, right? You turn a commission from a sale into a very motivated buyer. So again, can be done over and over. We have an expression in the industry, I'm sure you've all heard it before, but swap till you drop. And so again, it's one of the benefits of a 1031 is that you can continue to leverage this and essentially continue your investment, which was the spirit for which 100 years ago, the 1031 exchange was implemented into the tax code, albeit a different section number. But the spirit of it is just the same, to stimulate investment in now real property assets.
Hey, Eric, how much time does the taxpayer or the person, just so we're clear on terms, the person selling the investment property, how much time do they need before their actual closing to get all those docs kind of lined up? The day before, a couple of days before? And I know it depends on like a lot of probably different states and all that.
So that's a great question. Again, for the realtors, we can be of tremendous assistance in getting and assisting them in getting a listing, because oftentimes the pushback from an investor is, well, I've owned this for 20 years. I don't want to sell it. I'm going to have to pay taxes. So if we can be on a call with them and sort of spoon feed them and walk them through the process so that they can visualize it and understand it, that's often the first and most important step for a realtor to get a listing. To answer your question specifically, once it's in contract or in escrow, depending on what it's being called geographically, that's really the appropriate time for us to spring into action to generate the documentation that I mentioned earlier that's necessary for a 1031. But we have, to answer your question as far as from the fire drill perspective, and we had this, maybe it was 4 or 5 months ago, but at a closing table, we've turned documents around. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't love to have to drop everything, but we will do it. So just again, a few days is sufficient. Obviously that can be a little bit tight because we want to have a little bit of a more easy information flow and make sure we get everything. And so anytime, again, we can do it 15 minutes in advance. That's not ideal.
It happens.
That's good.
All right. So once we've closed on the disposition of our relinquished property, The Internal Revenue Code requires that a limited number of potential new replacement properties be identified within 45 days from the date that the relinquished property is closed. Now, the identification is sort of the easiest and the most difficult thing for a taxpayer to do within that very short window of time. It goes very quickly. Taxpayers are often under a lot of stress to submit their limited list of potential new properties. And there are a couple of ways you can identify a replacement property. The first rule is that within the 45-day window, you can identify up to three potential replacement properties of any fair market value. So if Spencer is selling his 34th floor condo in Manhattan for $8 million, within the 45-day window, he can identify up to three potential replacement properties, whether it's farmland in Oklahoma or wherever. Each of those properties could be worth $100 million. It doesn't matter what the fair market value is. If, on the other hand, Spencer wants to identify more than three replacement properties, then the rules require that the combined value of all of the properties identified can't exceed two times the value of the property that was sold. So when we're selling our condo in New York for $8 million, Spencer wants to identify five replacement properties, the combined values of all of those properties can't exceed $16 million. It's just a very arbitrary limiter that prevents a taxpayer from identifying hundreds of potential replacement properties.
No, I was just going to say, and it probably just worth noting sort of two things to that point. There are calendar days, so there are no exceptions for Saturdays, Sundays, holidays. Sometimes people think it's just business days. That's not the case. Also right. A common misconception. Just thought I'd inject that. And in all cases, regardless of the rule that you're using, if you're using a product like Spencer's, a tenant in common investment, or if you're going to buy something with a friend, we'll get in a little bit later about the fact that you can't trade partnership interests, but the point is you need to identify that percentage interest that's being acquired.
Fair, good.
So I think you're touching on the 95%.
Yeah, so 95% is really an exception rule that we don't see utilized very often. If a taxpayer does identify more than three replacement properties, and if the values of those properties exceed two times the value of the relinquished property, then as long as the taxpayer acquires at least 95% or essentially all of the replacement properties that they've identified, then their identification will still be valid. Again, it's an exception rule. Probably don't really need to remember it, but it's out there.
But I think it's also worth noting that, and it's certainly would not be recommended to identify that way and be past your 45th calendar date. But in the event that a taxpayer in Mary and Spencer's example sold a condo in New York, if you bought eight pieces of property that exceeded the 200%, you spent $25 million, but you closed on all of it within mm-hmm. the first 45 calendar days, just understand that would be okay.
That's correct, right. Any property that's closed within the 45-day window is deemed to have been identified. So as Eric mentioned, the 45 days is calendar days. There are generally no exceptions or extensions with some limited, there are some limited exceptions if the property falls within a natural disaster area or a federally declared disaster area. But generally, taxpayers have to ensure that they identify timely within that 45-day window. What happens, Eric? What do we tell taxpayers if they submit their form on day 46? Or perhaps they don't identify at all and they call us and say, but I signed a contract on day 30 to buy this property. What kind of options do we have?
Well, so if they did sign a contract for replacement property and there was what we call cooperation clause language in there, putting the other party on notice that it would be part of a 1031 exchange, that would look okay. To the extent that they didn't get into contract and they just send us something on day 46, unfortunately, that ship has sailed. Now, that being said, as Mary said, there are from time to time presidentially declared disasters. And for example, we've seen it for hurricanes, floods, fires in California, which typically will extend that deadline for 120 days or a date certain that they may have in there. Mary, why don't you comment? I know the question will arise regarding COVID, and are there any current extensions?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, there are not. Back in April of 2020, the IRS did issue a little bit of relief to 1031 investors in that they allowed for an extension of both the 45-day period and the 180-day period for any investors that were involved in like-kind exchanges beginning on or after April 1st through July 14th of 2020. It allowed you to just extend those dates to July 15th of 2020. We did beseech them effectively for more relief, but you know, sadly, nothing else has come out of Treasury since then. They've got a lot of other things that they're working on. So we do get that question, it's true, frequently. Is there any kind of, you know, extension because of COVID? And the answer at this point in time is no.
And, you know, so to Mary's question earlier to me, and this is just a cautionary tale for the realtors on the call, is if you get approached by somebody to help them find some investment property, I would suggest the first thing you're going to want to do is, among other things, maybe see their critical deadlines. We as a qualified intermediary will generate that those dates for the taxpayer based on the date that they closed in the settlement statement. But as we'll get into a little further regarding some of the debt and equity requirements, at a bare minimum with regard to those deadlines, if somebody approaches you on day 50 to help them find some investment property, barring any sort of extension that they may be subject to, you're wasting your time.
Good point.
Here's a good question for you guys. So someone identifies and you have a form that they fill out with all the properties they want to identify, correct?
Yeah, that's yes. A great question. Yeah, we provide a form for them to use and it is recommended that it's returned to us by that bidder.
And so what do you do with that form? Who at the IRS do you turn that into? What, you know, who do they have to submit that to any government agency? What happens to the form after they identify?
So we acknowledge receipt of it, Spencer, but we're not providing that form to the IRS. Once the taxpayer has completed their exchange, they, along with their accountant, will file an information return, 8824. And that form will ask them to disclose the date in which relinquished property was disposed of, the date in which replacement property was identified and acquired. So it helps them certainly to have the acknowledged identification form. They could attach it to that information return if they wish, but we are not filing that with the IRS.
Yeah, and unfortunately there are some, as they're referred to in the industry, accommodative accommodators who may take an identification late. I mean, that is committing tax fraud and it's doing the taxpayer a disservice. As Mary's saying, there was a question directly on the 8824 to state the date that you identified your replacement property. So it's incumbent on the taxpayer to prove that. So we take things over email, a PDF can be sent to us up to 11:59 p.m. on their 45th calendar day, and then everybody's happy. But really absent that, you're playing with fire.
Good insight there. So if I'm the taxpayer and I have it in my mind, yeah, I'm going to identify this property and the deadline passes. Mm-hmm. According to the IRS, it has not been identified if it just stays up here and it's not written down and it's not submitted.
Right. Very specifically has to be in a written document that's signed by
good.
You.
Good.
All right. When we go to buy our replacement property, again, we want to remember that the property needs to be investment property or property that's used in a trade or business. That's fine, Eric. You can go to the next one. Thank you. We do occasionally get questions about personal use of both relinquished and replacement properties by the taxpayer. Is it okay for a taxpayer to use the new single family home in Florida that they're intending to rent out for 5 or 6 months out of the year? There's some very specific guidance on the limitations that a taxpayer must abide by if they want to use replacement property for personal use purposes. And those basically say that property, if they're using it for personal use purposes, their use of it has to be limited to 14 days out of the year or 10% of the number of days that the property is actually rented. And it does actually have to be rented. So we do talk to people a lot about this. They think they're buying a vacation home that they'll just sort of rent out occasionally and it will be qualifying property. But there's a very specific safe harbor that if you want to qualify as investment property, you need to make sure you fall within the four corners of.
And Eric? Probably worth noting that having a family member, maybe your child or your mother or father, use that property is deemed your personal use as well. So be very careful with that.
Yes, very good. All right, that's our Florida vacation home. Oh, so on to partnerships. A lot of real estate is held in partnerships. And as you may know, 1031 does not apply to the exchange of an interest in a partnership. Now, if Spencer and Eric and I hold property together in the SEM LLC, which is a tax partnership, we can certainly do an exchange in the name of the partnership and buy replacement property together. We can also exchange tenancy and common interests if we happened to hold the property as co-tenants and not through an entity that is a partnership. But generally, the most common question that we see is, it's a three-person partnership, for example, and the partners each have different objectives. Let's say two want to do an exchange and one wants to sell for cash. What is the best way for us to sort of address each taxpayer's objectives? And you may have heard of this structure called a drop and swap, where the partnership itself is terminated and co-tenancy interests in the property are deeded to the individual investors. And then they hold on to that property for some period of time. And then they can either exchange their interests or sell their interests. But the tricky thing with the drop and swap is, as we said at the beginning, property to be qualifying for 1031 purposes has to be held for investment or for use in a trade or business. Once we take that property out of the partnership and distribute co-tenancy interest to the individuals, for 1031 purposes, from the IRS's view, the holding period sort of starts over for those co-tenants. There is some case law. We can talk about the Chase case was a similar case where a taxpayer took a deed from a partnership of which he was a member. The partners, former partners, continued to act like partners. They paid all of the expenses and took all the revenue into their partnership account. And the deed to Mr. Chase was never recorded. So he was deemed to have sold his interest in the underlying partnership and not his interest in the real estate. Also, there are two published rulings from the IRS that are still on the books. The IRS has said in public forums that they still stand by, in which they've said that, again, that held for investment requirement cannot be transferred to that co-tenant, for example, when we take the property out of the partnership. There is some positive case law that's pro-taxpayer, where the taxpayer has prevailed in arguing that their investment in the underlying real estate is exactly the same as it was when it was owned by the partnership. It's mostly in the Ninth Circuit. So you want to be careful if you're doing an exchange of property that's owned by a partnership and some of the partners want to leave and some of them want to do the exchange. It takes a little bit of advanced planning.
Yeah, and then also at the state level, right, we see California and the California Franchise Tax Board attacking all things 1031. And so, you know, we've seen cases go both ways there as well. So you really want to engage with some counsel to address your circumstance.
Yeah. So that's our pitfall number four. You want to make sure that before you go kind of headlong into the like-kind exchange, you want to make sure you understand how title to the property is vested, to the relinquished property, and what the party's intentions are relative to their replacement property, so that the same tax owner, tax-paying entity that owns the relinquished property will also be buying the replacement property.
And probably also worth a cautionary tale for the realtors. If somebody engages you to look for some replacement property, again, find out who was the taxpayer that sold the property. Maybe a partnership where, like Mary said, Spencer, myself, we own it together. But Spencer, I hate to tell you, you are the 1% owner and you have no say in what happens. And you went to a realtor and say, hey, find us some replacement property. But really, Mary and I are making the decisions. And so again, you want to understand who is the taxpayer. There are many misconceptions where partners think they're just going to get their interest when the property is sold to do their own 1031. But again, without that proper structuring, or unless it's set up already as tenants in common, that's not going to happen.
So the general, you know, ideal here is to maximize your deferral of gain, right? And to not have to recognize any gain and pay any tax. If a taxpayer receives cash or other non-like-kind property in the exchange that is typically referred to as boot. So boot causes a taxpayer to have to recognize some gain. And sort of the general way to think about how to maximize your deferral is make sure you acquire replacement property at least of equal value to the property that is sold, and make sure that all of the equity from the disposition of the relinquished property is invested into replacement property. And if you do both of those things, buy property of equal value, spend all of your equity on replacement property, you'll avoid having any boot in your transaction. Of course, it's okay to take cash out if that's what you want to do. A lot of investors are interested in taking some cash out after they've held onto a property for a long period of time and they just want to have some cash to do something else with. That's fine. You can have a partially tax deferred transaction. But if you do want to maximize the deferral, these two rules will always get you there.
And what's sort of not stated there, Mary, is, and showed in these examples, but that again is a common misconception that, oh, I only have to buy something equal or greater in value. And that's not the case. You do need to spend all the equity, as Mary said, but what's kind of not stated in that is what that statement means is you also have to replace the debt that is paid off. And so whatever that net equity is, when you buy something equal or greater in value, that means you're replacing the debt that you may have had on the relinquished property. But again, you're not forced to take another mortgage, but it does need to be replaced. So if you want to buy a property and, you know, not go through the exercise with a bank, if you're in the financial position to substitute fresh equity, then that's okay.
Right. So you can always offset that debt that you're relieved of with either new debt or cash. So in our example here, we have unexpected cash or mortgage boot. And what can we do with this? We assume we're selling our property for $100. It's subject to a mortgage of $50, and we have $50 of equity. We identify one replacement property on day 10. Let's say that property is worth $85. We spend $35 of our equity, and we put new debt on that replacement property of $50. So we've offset our debt there, but we still have cash that we have yet to reinvest into replacement property. This is where the tenancy in common investment is a really great backstop, as a way to eat up additional excess cash or even excess mortgage boot that would otherwise occur in the transaction. So identifying that second replacement property is a really good way to avoid having any boot in the transaction.
And probably worth noting, and I'm sure Spencer sees this all the time, and as do we, is somebody may not even be in contract on replacement property one, but they know that it's going to be 85. And as Mary said, knowing that there's going to be some residual amount, they identify a tenant in common investment. But also, if they have that other identification slot available, that replacement property one might blow up and not work out. So to have another backup, whether it be a tenant in common or otherwise, is a good idea. Brings us to our conclusion here. So, you know, as was stated, I think a little bit about us, CDEC is part of Wintrust Bank. I think that's an important point. The 1031 exchange industry, unfortunately, is unregulated. And we have seen Ponzi schemes and bankruptcies. And there's a whole episode on American Greed on CNBC about QI defalcations. So working with a bank provides a significantly higher level of security to the transaction. We take things a step further, utilizing a dual safe harbor, operating every exchange through a trust. So by operation of law, that is not an asset of the QI nor the trustee. And Mary and I were a team of 9 people consisting of attorneys and a number of certified exchange specialists, and hope to be a resource for you and your clients anytime. And I think with that, we were going to turn it back over to Spencer to share a little bit about Mill Creek.
Perfect. Thank you. Thank you very much. I hope that if you have questions, you feel comfortable calling Mary and Eric. They can help you. One takeaway I hope everyone walks away with is 1031 exchanges can be very complex. There's certain personal aspects that are only, you know, unique to you. Just ask a question, right? Find out what information do you need to make kind of the right decision, and there's resources here that can help. So let me run through a real life example. So we were introduced to landlords a little while ago. They bought a high quality property back in the 1970s. It was near a major university. It was first used as their primary residence. And as they grew in their career, they decided to turn it into a rental, which a lot of landlords kind of fall into this category of like accidental landlordship, right? The division of labor was such that he was in charge of the maintenance and the repairs and that sort of thing. And she was in charge of filling vacancy, vetting tenants, advertising, paying all the bills. And this is great because there's the benefits that they enjoyed over time were that the tenants paid off their mortgage. They experienced a lot of appreciation. I don't know if there are many markets in the US right now that are not just booming with appreciation, but this particular one was in kind of a downtown area of Salt Lake City. Lots of appreciation over that 35, 40 year period. Rents increased over time, and they enjoyed all the tax benefits of owning that real estate, right? So it became too much for them, as it does with a lot of landlords. Running the property, finding tenants, it just becomes more of a burden. So they went to their CPA. Their CPA told them, if you sell, there's going to be some tax consequences Mary and Eric talked about. You'll have to pay capital gains. It could be 15, it could be 20%. You're going to do something, you're going to have to pay something called a depreciation recapture. You took depreciation on your asset, or you should have taken depreciation on your asset over 27 and a half years. Well, you have to pay it back, and you have to pay it back at a rate of 25% tax. There's the net investment income tax, or the NIIT, 3.8%. There's also other taxes, state income tax, and a couple other taxes that will apply, but those are kind of the three constant ones. Okay. So they're thinking about selling. They go to their financial planner, and he suggested some annuity products, some different products that he offered, right? And so they were kind of, okay, well, what do we do? So this is kind of what it would look like. They sell their property for $500,000, estimated taxes around $160,000. So they're left with a total of $340,000. Right? The certified financial planner recommends products that will spin off about a 4% return. It comes out to about $1,100 a month based on the $340,000. The CPA said, you guys, check out an annuity. It's going to pay you about $3,000 a month. The only problem with that is at the end of the annuity, there's no nest egg for you to pass on to your heirs. So the daughter got involved, and she didn't really like that. So she searched the internet for a lot of, you know, different topics: deferring taxes, not paying taxes, selling real estate. What can you do, right? So she did a whole Google search on that, and she came across 1031 exchange. She connected us with her parents, and now they sell their rental for $500,000, and they exchange into a Mill Creek property. Our offerings offer about a 6% return. So now they're making $30,000 a year off of that $500,000. They were able to defer all the taxes, state income tax, depreciation recapture, capital gains, net investment income tax, all that. And they also went from a residential rental into a part owner of a commercial asset, which you can do, as Mary and Eric explained. They went from replacing the tenant every year or every 2 years to now a commercial asset that has a 10 or 15 year lease. They are able to diversify that 500,000 over three different properties in three different states, three different types of tenants. And their monthly cash flow, the real dollars in their pocket, increased by 50%. And they still have the deeded interest in their assets. So it was a hedge against inflation and all the benefits of owning real estate, right? They got to continue any tax write-offs, they got to continue enjoying those. When we left the title company's conference room, right? And he signed the docs. His comment was, I'll never have to mow that lawn again, right? This gentleman was in their mid 70s and it had become a burden, right? To maintain the property and maintain and collect rent checks and all that stuff. So moving from a residential investment that at one point in their life brought a lot of value to their portfolio and all that had become just a little too much for them to handle. And so we love this comment. I'll never have to mow that lawn again. At Mill Creek Commercial, and this is my last slide, basically what it is we do is we buy a commercial asset. We buy or develop a commercial asset, single tenant, which means one building, one tenant, triple net lease, meaning the tenant covers all expenses of ownership and operating that building. They pay the property taxes, insurance, they pay the maintenance, you know, broken window, clogged toilet, whatever it might be, broken sprinkler head, right? The tenant pays for all that. And we like assets with a long-term lease already in place. And that lease is strong with a corporate guarantee. So the tenant is financially able to pay rent on a building if they ever vacate that before the lease before the initial lease is up. So we like that. We think kind of if we can get three of those four combinations, that brings a lot of stability and security and peace of mind to the portfolio. So after we buy those buildings, you know, for lack of a better illustration, we slice it up like a pizza and you can come in and buy whatever slice of pizza you need to buy. So we're a fantastic solution for Boot. We have low minimums. We've done Boot, you know, almost upwards to $1 million, but we've also done Boot like $45,000 to $95,000 to $112,000. And we can meet the Boot to the penny, whatever that need is. So that's just kind of a little bit on Mill Creek Commercial. And I don't know. Let's, Eric, Mary, should we open it up for questions? I don't know. Is there anything else we want to touch on before we go into Q&A?
Well, I mean, I think it's just worth noting it's something that Mary and I regularly speak on and for hours. So this was definitely a boil down. We tried to make it relevant for the audience that we expect. And so I imagine, you know, please understand there's so much more to all of this, but we try to, you know, boil it down to some important things. And so that would just be my caveat about it.
So there's contact info for here for Eric. Happy to jump on a phone call or engage over email to ask questions. But Brian's going to ask a question here that I think a lot of people have, and it's worth repeating because it's not that intuitive. He says, can you confirm you can sell a single family rental and exchange into multifamily? So Mary, how would you answer that?
Unequivocally, yes. Yes. No problem at all. Yes. So that's the nice thing about the like-kind standard. It's very broad. And so any real property that's held for investment or for use in a trade or business is considered to be like-kind to any other real property held for investment or for use in a trade or business. No problem.
We're going to get, so I only want to touch on the political aspect lightly because this could take several day seminar to talk about this, but an anonymous attendee asked, do you foresee the new administration ending 1031 exchanges immediately, but even will they have any impact on this part of the IRS code?
I mean, I don't see them ending 1031 immediately, and some of our attendees may know that the Biden campaign, when they first put out their tax plan in February of last year, did include some language regarding repealing abusive real estate provisions. And there was a lot of talk in the community about whether or not their proposed limitation for certain preferential real estate provisions to limitation to taxpayers who earned in excess of $400,000 per year, whether that meant 1031 or not. You know, our advisors, our outside advisors think that their intention initially was to repeal 1031. I will say again, this came out in February before the pandemic was sort of in full swing and before we went into the recession and then had partial recovery, et cetera. We are very much in touch with legislators on the Hill and opinion leaders who are close to Biden to ensure that they understand how critical 1031 is to the economy. And I think they do. I mean, the reception that we've gotten with all of the meetings we've had all virtually via Zoom has been extremely encouraging. Nobody wants to kneecap real estate at this juncture where we're, you know, still in the midst of a raging pandemic and a lot of people are out of work. So I guess I would say stay tuned. We've been here before. We fought this fight a few times over the last 25 years, and I expect and hope we will be successful again.
Yeah, and I think it's probably worth noting also, Mary was being bashful, but she is on the Government Affairs Committee of the Federation of Exchange Accommodators, which is the only national 1031 exchange organization, in conjunction with a whole coalition, National Association of Realtors, it goes on and on, all are working together. And so we have lobbyists on this, and CDEC has been very involved just, you know, in conjunction with that organization also. So Mary's providing a little bit of, you know, unique insight.
I think there's a lot of policy that gets, you know, started in Congress and whatnot in the House. And, you know, and most of the time you can put those different topics, okay, this is on the right, this is on the left, you know, whatever. But in terms of real estate, this is very much like a nonpartisan, like, issue, right? Like Democrats, Republicans, whoever, they all own real estate. They all benefit from owning real estate.
Not just
tax, but also income, right? They, know, so it's in my mind, I kind of see it as very nonpartisan. You know, unlike a lot of the other policies,
We do try to educate, you know, sort of congressional representatives that, you know, this is something that's used by the person that has a two-family home that may be worth $200,000. I mean, this is not something that's always a $10 million transaction. As we touched on, many parts of 1031s have already been repealed in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and that included things for artwork and aircraft. And I don't think anybody was going to play a violin for the person that sold their $10 million Picasso. But when we talk about real property and the impact that it would have to the GDP of this country, both from anybody from the realtor to obviously the taxpayer themselves, to a bank, to a title insurance company, right down to the local roofer. Because oftentimes, of course, when people buy an investment property, the first thing they do is fix it up. And so it just transcends so many people. I hope and expect that we are doing a good job in educating people the damage this would cause. And
yeah, that's a really good insight.
Accounting firms to do economic studies. And so we have the data to show this.
Let's dive into this definition of what exactly is investment property. Brian asks, is a single family home used exclusively as an Airbnb rental, short-term rental, considered an investment property? So take us through, what is the definition of an investment property? I would like to know, does it need to generate any annual income? And what you know, in the eyes of the IRS, what is it and what is it not?
So investment property for 1031 purposes does not need to be income generating. It does not. If you have a single family home that you're using exclusively for Airbnb purposes, so you're not using it for personal use purposes and you're depreciating it on your books, I would say absolutely that is qualifying property. You know, in our example, go ahead, Eric. Go ahead.
So the investor, or we're calling them an investor, but somebody bought it, did a little work, spackle paint, gave it to a realtor to sell, but while it's being sold, it's being treated as an Airbnb.
So how long have they held it in your example? 6 months?
Sure, 6 months.
Okay. So that person would definitely not qualify as an investor of real property. So, I mean, the code says property has to be held for investment or for use in a trade or business. So those words held for imply some sort of holding period, although there's no bright line test that says it has to be 2 years or it has to be 18 months. But so you want to look at the investor's activity relative to the property. So Eric, in your example, where you bought your single family home and you're doing some painting and a little bit of spackle, and you immediately put it on the market for sale while that work is being done and renting it out for a short period of time, it's clear that your intention relative to that property was to buy it for resale. So as to you, that would be inventory and not investment property.
So I'm gonna go one level deeper on this, Mary. What if you bought the house and you're fixing it up and you start renting at Airbnb, and then after three lodgers, then you put it up for sale? Does that make a difference?
I would again ask you sort of how long you've owned it. Were the lodgers each there for a weekend, or, you know, were they each there for 6 months at a time?
Yeah, I mean, it really comes back to the intent. Did they buy this home and treat it as an investment property all along, or was their intent? That's why I threw in that little relevant fact that if they bought it, fix it up quickly, immediately gave it to a realtor, as Mary said, that the intent was to resell it. The fact that they rented along the way a little bit doesn't change the fact that their intent was to resell it.
Right.
So, you know, we always will kind of have a more global discussion. It's, you know, if you give us a little fact pattern that you leave some things out just because you didn't think about it, it can make all the difference in the world.
You know, that's different than, okay, I'm buying this house in a highly desirable area and it happens to be four streets away from my personal residence. Okay, I'm going to buy it. Now I'm starting to fix it up and I put it on the market for Airbnb. And then after three lodgers, okay, now I have to move across the country. Okay, now I have to sell it. Like, that's a different intent than.
Absolutely correct.
Yeah.
Absolutely correct.
Where you can have, and Mary and I have seen this, you can purchase a single family with the intent to rent it out. So if you did have that intent and you do in fact rent it out, but 4 months in, the tenant says to you, you know what, I'm never moving. I want to buy this property. And they give you a 25% premium. Well, you have the intent to treat it as an investment property. You never intended to sell it. That fact pattern, although you've held it for a relatively short period of time, probably less than we'd like to see, I think that would shake out on the side of the taxpayer.
I agree.
And all these conversations you're having with people who call, and so they start exploring 1031, you're kind of understanding what their intent is, as you say, yes, a 1031 exchange will benefit you, or gosh, I don't see a clear path on your, based on your intentions, that a 1031 exchange would work. This is why I encourage everyone. Okay, you have one little question. Call Mary and Eric and ask them and see if what you would like to do even fits within just kind of the safe harbor, and, you know, see if it qualifies as a 1031. Never not pick up the phone and call because you think, okay, well, I already know the answer. You don't know the answer. Make a phone call, right?
Yeah. Right.
And, you know, Spencer's probably just worth noting, we'll share with you and paint that picture with broad strokes. But although I'm an attorney, I can't give legal or tax advice. As a qualified intermediary, we're not permitted to do that. So we often suggest, you know, we'll loop in with the accountant, or we'll loop in with their counsel if necessary to, you know, to get a little better picture. I mean, I had that just yesterday where I had to speak to an accountant to get some additional facts in order to make sure they were on the same page with us. And so that's something that we regularly do.
So here's the next question talks about crossing state lines. And so we know as a QI, Mary, you're in Chicago, right?
Yes.
Eric, you're in New York.
That's correct.
You can help anyone in the country with their 1031 exchange. They do not need to be limited to the state that you reside in.
That's right.
This question's a little unique. It says, if I have a property in Utah, then 1031 exchange into a property in Nevada, then sell the Nevada property after a few years. For the final sale in Nevada, do I still need to go back to Utah and pay any tax in Utah?
So yeah, that's a great question. So I don't want to stick my neck out too far, but I will tell you definitively, for example, and this raises the question about states. There are so many states. California, for example, does have a clawback provision. And so had you sold in California, bought in Nevada, ultimately sell your Nevada property, yes, you are going to have to pay California those taxes that you would have paid initially if you had just done the outright sale. So I don't know, Mary, if you know off the top of your head.
Yeah, I don't know off the top of my head either if Utah has a clawback, but we do know for sure California is very aggressive about making sure that they track that gain and get the tax when that replacement property is ultimately sold. But it's definitely worth checking out if you are going from one state to another, so you're not surprised.
And just for example, Pennsylvania doesn't recognize 1031.
Right.
So although you can sell in Pennsylvania, buy in Nevada, and benefit at the federal level, you will have to pay the state income tax.
Right.
So many, many nuances. We can help you navigate through much of that. Obviously, I can check real quick and see if there's a clawback for Utah, I think you said, but certainly ping us. I'm happy to check on that for you.
Okay, so there are some landlords out there who, when they're ready to sell their what's called their relinquished property or the investment property that they've owned for several years, they decide to sell it on terms. You know, they'll take $10,000 down today and monthly payments of $1,000. And then there's like a balloon in a year or 18 months or something like that, right? How do the worlds of 1031 exchange mesh with landlords selling their investment property to someone on terms?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's tricky, actually. I just had a situation like this yesterday. So the idea is that at the initial closing, when that buyer provides the initial deposit to the seller, that's the seller turns over possession and benefits and burdens of ownership, even if not legal title to the property. The buyer now possesses the property, has benefits and burdens of ownership. That's when the clock starts to run for 1031 purposes. So if you're selling on terms, you want to make sure you get your exchange set up at the time that initial deposit is received. Now, if the taxpayer has the ability to monetize that installment contract, right, to buy it out so that they can put cash into the exchange within the 180-day period, then they can have a successful like-kind exchange and defer all of their tax and then receive the balance of the payments over the period of the installment contract. If they can't, if they don't have the wherewithal to put cash in to sort of monetize that installment contract, well, then they're able to just defer the gain on the payments that are received within the exchange period. So Spencer, in your example, if we're only getting $1,000 payments per month, it's, you know, pretty small amount of cash that you have that you can defer the gain on and when you're reinvesting in replacement property. So the best option is to have, you know, if you have the ability, monetize that installment contract, put cash into the exchange so you can buy the property, replacement property, without having to recognize the gain. Eric, any other thoughts on that?
No, I agree. I mean, I think that covers it. Ideally, you sell to your purchaser for all cash, or, you know, with their financing, but without that's in an ideal world. And I know sometimes that gets it over the finish line. So as Mary said, you may just subject yourself to some taxes, but in a best case scenario, or second best, is that if you're in the financial position to substitute that the seller financed piece, inject the cash into the exchange account, then you will defer all your taxes. And then as the principal payments are made outside of the exchange, that balloon in 5 years, whatever it is, that will be tax-free. Now, the interest will be taxable, right. The principal will not be subject to the capital gain if you substituted it at the time that you sold your property. So we see that, you know, quite often.
But interesting. Again, interesting.
Ideally, you try to get your buyer to buy it all cash or their own financing is what I mean.
Gunnar asked the question, do you need to state in the contract that the transaction is subject to a tax deferred exchange? I believe he's talking about the purchase and sale agreement or the REPSI. And should finding a replacement property be contingent on the first deal? Any thoughts on that?
Look, it's not required that you disclose you're doing a like-kind exchange. I think what you want to make sure is true in the contract is that there's no prohibition against your ability to assign the contract, because at closing or prior to closing, you'll be assigning your rights in the contract to the intermediary on both sides of the transaction. So as long as there's no prohibition to that, I don't think you necessarily have to have language, but it doesn't hurt unless you feel like you're giving up a point of leverage, right? So making your acquisition contingent on the disposition of relinquished property may be a leverage point for that replacement property seller. So that's really a negotiation tactic in my view. Eric, what do you think?
Yeah, well, I was just going to encourage all the realtors on the line that I know many states realtors generate those contracts. Just make it boilerplate language, because Spencer may be selling his single family home that he lives in that has nothing to do with a 1031, but I might be selling my shopping center and want to buy his home that I'm going to treat as an investment property. So why not just have some reciprocal language in there in all of your contracts? And then you're not tipping a hand one way or the other. Nobody should object to it. And I just find that it's not a good look when, and Mary and I conduct a lot of continuing legal education classes. When I'm working with an attorney and we see this, and it's unfortunate, and you know, they don't have cooperation clause language, they never brought up the concept of a 1031, when they know that the taxpayer is selling a multifamily or they're selling an office building. I mean, it should be part of a conversation. And it should have been in the contract. And if it were just boilerplate, then it would be there and they wouldn't have had to think about it. But it's not a good look when somebody is selling investment property, you know, clearly, and there was no discussion of a 1031.
John asked the question. He says, like, I thought you couldn't 1031 into a triple net investment. And so
absolutely,
we deal exclusively with triple net properties. I mean, and there's reasons for that, right? If you look at the different types of properties, like the different, it's all real estate, but the different classes. So you have vacant land. Vacant land does not really produce a lot of monthly income. Then you have like strip malls, right? Strip mall, 5 different stores. Tenants are changing all the time. Everyone's on like different lease terms, right? So there's kind of headache that comes with some of that, right? Then you have office. Office, you know, as the landlord, you're paying a lot in like tenant improvements. And office, you know, let's say someone signs a lease for 5 years in an office. Well, at the end of 5 years, they're going to come back and negotiate. Okay, well, we want you to redo our tenant improvement and we'll sign another 5-year lease, right? So there's a lot of decisions with that. Industrial's pretty boring. There's not a whole lot, you know, I don't know.
Unless
I don't want to.
Amazon comes along and buys your property.
There's multifamily, constant changeover in, you know, apartment rentals and whatnot. We like single tenant triple net because we feel like you get the highest return relative to the amount of work from the landlord needed. So we like it because you know, Dollar General, for example, let's just take them. They sign a 15-year lease and probably 3 to 6 5-year extensions after that. They cover the cost of, you know, there's no tenant improvement. They just come in and put all their shelves in there, right? They cover property taxes, they cover insurance premiums, and most, if not all, the maintenance on the building, just kind of how the lease is structured. So in a single tenant triple net, very much the landlord could be completely absent for 19 years and never have to make a decision, right? And so that's why we play in the triple net lease properties. But it doesn't matter, kind of, and correct me if I'm wrong, it doesn't matter how the lease is set up. What matters is you go from investment property to investment property.
Right.
Yeah. What's been the most unique situation you guys have seen someone either come out of or go into in terms of uniqueness of real estate?
You go first, Eric. I have a good one.
Go for it.
Well, we did the exchange of the lipstick building in New York, if you know what that is.
Huh.
Do you, Eric?
Of course.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Here I am in Utah. I'm like, I don't know what the lipstick building is. I'm like,
it had one
wild,
famous,
wild west.
I think it had one famous tenant who orchestrated a Ponzi scheme for a number of years and is now in federal prison, but owner, just a tenant there.
But I think it represents that, you know, we've been involved with Fortune 500 companies, with publicly traded REITs, you know, things, $1 billion plus transactions. But of course, I don't want to scare people away. It's right down to the, you know, I currently am working with somebody selling some single family homes in Pittsburgh, and they're $45,000 each. I didn't know you could buy a single family. I'm in New York. I didn't know you could get one for $45,000. But, you know, so anyway, it really runs the gamut. I think we really just pride ourselves on being a resource for taxpayers and assisting them. And, you know, whether it's large or small, I think we're providing the security based on what the largest investors require. And that just cascades down, and the smallest of investors benefit from that.
Let's end with one more question from David. And I know reverse exchanges can get really complicated, but just give like the 30,000 foot view answer to his question. Could you describe a reverse exchange and its limitations?
Sure. So reverse exchange occurs when you need to close on the purchase of your replacement property before you can sell your relinquished property. And the way you structure that is you hire a company like ours, and what we would do is take legal title to that new property and hold it and net lease it to you for up to 180 days. And then during that 180 day period, you would sell your relinquished property, and then we would transfer that parked replacement property back to you as to complete the exchange. Frequently, taxpayers want to do a reverse exchange to improve property, whether it's ground up or just to do a renovation or capital improvements to property. So the limitations that I see most commonly on the reverse exchange is you're still limited. If you want to be within the safe harbor, you're still limited to that 180 day time period to get that sort of construction or the value of the improvements into that replacement property while it's held. That's probably the only downside. Eric, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that you use opportunistically, or if you have, for example, I have an exchange that we're about to work on, Mary doesn't even know yet, but somebody is selling a car dealership in one state and buying a car dealership in another state. Now, they have to make their acquisition by the middle of February, and their sale has been delayed, and it's not going to close until March or April. So it's a perfect example of where, you know, you can't just sell, you know, your condo and find some type of other investment property or put it into one of Spencer's tenant in common investments. You're doing this for a business use. It's usually typically an owner occupied, or for example, it could be, you know, somebody mentioned earlier has a warehouse and that's their business, and maybe they're growing and they need to expand. Well, they're going to have a real set of specific requirements, both geographically and by size. And so it's an opportunity to not be up against the clock on the acquisition side, find what meets your parameters. And then you can usually, through price reductions, if you have to, sell your property within that timely 180 calendar days.
Well, as we wrap up here, I want to fire two more questions off to you, Eric. What advice will you give to the landlords on this webinar? Like what's a tip you'd give the landlords, just maybe looking at possibly doing a 1031 exchange? Mary, what advice would you give the real estate agent that's attending to help, you know, become more knowledgeable about 1031 exchange to better serve their clients? Eric.
So I guess the first thing I'll say really applies to both, which is, you know, certainly we're happy to assist people through the process, but I would, as I just harken back to what I said earlier, that it's an unregulated industry and you don't want to be one of those statistics that lost your money in a Ponzi scheme. So really do your due diligence on the qualified intermediary that you're going to work with, understand the security of your funds, the experience that they're bringing to the table, the service they're going to provide to you. I can't tell you the number of times where people get introduced to me after the fact by their accountant, their attorney, whoever, to answer questions, and they're already in the middle of an exchange. I'm happy to assist. I kind of question why they're calling me. And it's typically because whoever they're working with is non-responsive or doesn't know the answers. So that's really a bad situation. So that kind of goes to both parties. But yeah, I mean, as far as for the landlords, to the best you can, try to line your ducks up. You know, if you can get into contract to sell something and get into contract to purchase something at the same time, that's great. I mean, you know, as we talk about, you can get into contract to purchase something now, even though, and you may be in contract to sell too, or you may not, but you can usually through negotiations, if I wanted to buy a property from you, Spencer, now, and I say to you, listen, I'll pay you $1,000 a month. Let me tell you when I'm ready to close. And I've now bought myself additional time so that I can get my existing relinquished property sold. So there's, you know, some of those business terms that you can do to help yourself through the process.
Thank you, Eric.
All right, to the realtors on the call, I would say always ask if 1031 is an appropriate option. It's, you know, even if you don't think it's, you know, investment property, you may be surprised to learn that whatever your client is selling could be investment property. And it's never inappropriate to ask, and you'd be sorry if you didn't ask and you lost the opportunity. So always appropriate to ask if they've thought about 1031.
Just 2 cents on that tip, Mary. I think a lot of new realtors, residential realtors, they're new, maybe they're 2, 3, 4, 5 years into the real estate game. They kind of treat every transaction like, you know, I don't want to blow this up. Right? I can't say something that's going to hurt. If you bring up 1031 exchange, all you're doing is bringing more value.
Absolutely.
Because my dad didn't know about 1031 exchanges. He owns like 10 rentals. He didn't know about 1031 exchanges until Mill Creek had been around for, 2 or 3 years. And I've told him on every family vacation about 1031 exchanges. And finally it just clicked, right? Like, oh, so I can do that. There are so many landlords out there who have no idea. And when the real estate agent brings it up, hey, what are your plans for 1031? And they go, well, I don't know what that is. You can educate them, connect them with CDEC. And now all of a sudden they're not paying taxes. They're increasing their portfolio, and you just, they're so much better off for knowing about that, right? So good tip.
And I think, Spencer, one of the last things for the landlords is, again, understand how you own that property. If you own it by yourself, wonderful, then that's easy. But as we kind of touched on, and it's really, it was a boiled down version of a much larger presentation, is if you own it in a partnership, you know, you want to get ahead of that. If you think you're going to sell it, or even if you don't think you're going to sell it now, you probably are going to sell it at some point. Try to get ahead of it, figure out a strategy so that you can go your separate way should you choose to. Doesn't mean happy. You can still both reinvest your money together, but at least give yourself that option to potentially cash out or do your own 1031 exchange. So it's something you do want to do as early as possible.
Mary and Eric, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And to all of our participants, thank you for logging in, joining us on this webinar. We love 1031 exchanges because we know how much they can help. If you have any questions, give us a call. call me, call Eric, call Mary. We would love to help. So thank you for joining us. This webinar will be available for download, including the slide deck. Mary, do I have your okay on that?
Sure.
Perfect. You can digest the slide deck. You can download the slide deck and use it.
I'll do one better is that, you know, for any of the realtors or, you know, even landlords, we do get presentations from time to time. We'd be more than happy to offer one to your real estate office. So, you know, Cool. Reach out. I know there are a ton of questions that we're going way over, and we appreciate everybody sticking with us, but please reach out and we'll get those questions answered for you.
Right on. And okay. So until next time, have a good day. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you,
Spencer. We sure appreciate it. Okay.
Take care, guys. Bye-bye.